This is the Infotagen podcast, discussing information contagion and our rights in a digital world. I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, we'll be discussing these issues with Sinan Aral, Director of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Initiative on the Digital Economy, and the author of a new book, The Hype Machine: How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt. We'll also be hearing from our regular guest, the disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Sinan, it's really great to have you on the podcast. I really enjoyed your new book published last year, The Hype Machine. But I wanted to just ask you a bit about your work before the publication of that book. Charles and I were in America in 2018 for the Select Committee inquiry on disinformation and fake news that I chaired. And we were in New York and Washington for that. But the following week, I actually visited Boston, visited MIT. I'm pretty sure we didn't meet at the time, to have some follow-up meetings to talk to some people at Harvard and MIT about the important research work that was being done looking at social media algorithms and fake news. And that was February 2018. I think the following month, you published, I think, a much quoted and quite groundbreaking piece of research on the way that fake news spreads on Twitter, and managed to demonstrate how disinformation spreads more effectively than real news. I'd like to ask you a bit about how that project started and what you took from it.
Yeah, so this was a 10-year longitudinal study of all of the true and false verified news that ever spread on Twitter from its inception in 2006 until 2017. So 10 years of data. It was in direct collaboration with Twitter, and Jack Dorsey endorsed the project himself as we began it. And so we had access to the historical archive, which means that we had access to every tweet that was ever tweeted, as long as it wasn't deleted by the time we collected the data. And, you know, that project started really because of the Boston Marathon bombing. And, you know, the research was done with Sarush Vasugi, who at the time that it started was a PhD student, and Deb Roy, who's a professor in the Media Lab. And we were in Boston during the Boston Marathon bombing. And as it was happening, there was a lot of misinformation spreading about who the bomber was, where the bomber was, what parts of the city were in danger. You may not know this, but an MIT police officer was shot and killed during the Boston Marathon bombing right there on our campus. And as we were watching the misinformation spread, it inspired Sarush to redirect his entire PhD thesis towards the study of misinformation. And that's really how it started. And then several years later, it culminated in this very large 10-year study of fake news on Twitter.
And I mean, the thing that I think that everyone latched onto and is much quoted is the sort of amplification effect of disinformation and fake news, that people are more drawn to it. It spreads more quickly than the real news. And we've seen in a number of, you know, terrorist-related events and disasters that often shortly after the event itself, there's fake footage of victims and of sometimes the alleged perpetrator that spreads very fast before the official news can get out. I mean, do you think from your experience working with Twitter, I mean, was there collaboration with you because they feel this is a problem that they have to try and solve?
I think that all of the social media platforms see it as a problem that they need to solve. And I think that they have varying levels of comfort with supporting research to really dig into it. And I have to, in this instance, applaud Twitter and Jack Dorsey for their transparency, because they did provide us a tremendous amount of data. They did not encumber us as we published the study. They didn't go in there with their legal team and their PR team and try to distort what we wrote. Everything that we wrote in that article, a lot of which was not helpful to Twitter at the time, was supported by them. And so I have to, you know, give them due credit for being transparent in that instance. And I think that overall, we see varying degrees of concern in the social platforms. But I think that there are other competing interests around reputation, shareholder value, and other types of concerns that sometimes lead to a lack of transparency, both in terms of making data accessible to researchers to do this kind of study, but also in terms of being truthful and open about the level of challenge they face in misinformation specifically.
Absolutely. Obviously, that was a great piece of research, but it was also published at a really great time to publish a piece of research like that, because it was not long after the revelations coming out of the Senate Intelligence Committee about Russian activities in terms of targeted advertising and bot networks on social media during the 2016 presidential election. And March 2018 was also when The Guardian and The New York Times broke the Cambridge Analytica story as well. And I've always looked back at that sort of period as being quite a sort of key moment in our understanding of the power of technology in society and what these social media platforms can do. And in some regard, the need for greater responsibility on behalf of the companies in terms of how they use their tech and what the social consequences are of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a watershed moment. I also, you know, my book opens with the story of the Russian annexation of Crimea. And I dig into this historical archive of tweets that we have about true and false news spreading. And the really interesting story that opens the hype machine is the story of fake news mixed with true news spreading in Crimea at the time of the annexation, which is well before 2018. And there what we find is that there was one spike of what we call mixed news, which is true and false news mixed together in the same story, that was four times bigger than any other spike in mixed news during the 10 years of data that we had. And that spike started and ended 1 month either side of the Russian annexation of Crimea. When I dug into those specific stories, I found that the top news stories that were mixed news spreading about Crimea had more significant bot activity than regular news, and that the top stories that were spreading were the exact same stories that Sergei Lavrov was talking about publicly at the UN and in other places. And when you see that kind of data and statistics that are such outliers in terms of four times larger than any other spike, a statistically significantly greater number of bots spreading the information, and verbatim the same words coming out of Sergei Lavrov's mouth at the same exact time that Russia was annexing Crimea, then it signals a deliberate attempt to manipulate opinions through falsity online.
And do you think, you know, we can and should learn from that and look at the patterns that are established around the launch of campaigns like that and be on alert if we see those patterns being repeated? It probably requires the tech companies to be the first movers in that regard. But do you think that is we can learn the way, learn how this works?
100%. I think this is our new reality. And it's not just limited to elections and democracy. You know, the subtitle of the book is How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Public Health. I think that's a triumvirate of current events that are so important at this moment, because obviously we're seeing effects on democracy. In terms of public health, we have a big issue around vaccine hesitancy that's linked to misinformation. And we still have a global pandemic that is raging in a lot of parts of the world. And when it comes to the economy, obviously here in the United States, we saw the rise of meme stocks that are going up and down based on misinformation and or just public rallying on social media. And so I think it has effects in many different disciplines. I do think that we have to learn, and we are learning, how to identify the spread of this type of misinformation, figure out what the causal impacts of this misinformation are on opinions and behaviors, what that means for society. And we've just held a social media summit at MIT in April that had the world's leading thinkers on this and related topics. 20,000 people saw it live, And the entire theme of the conference was, what do we do? What are the solutions? And so we've released a report that outlines 25 detailed solutions to the social media crisis that we're experiencing now.
I want to come on to that because that sounds absolutely fascinating for us. But I think you're right to highlight those different aspects of disinformation. And I think the last year, the period of the coronavirus, I think it's given a clear demonstration that actually disinformation can change people's behaviors. I think in the past, there was a bit of a rejection of the idea that a bit of Russian disinformation in an election would change the way I vote. I heard people say, well, I'd never be influenced by an ad I saw on Facebook or a tweet I saw. But I think what we've seen is that when new things come along, like a vaccination program for a new virus, people's opinions can be greatly influenced by what they read on social media. And it's not a question of how it's phrased or where it's written, but just the sheer volume of content asserting a certain opinion that people are exposed to that leaves them either not knowing what to believe at all or believing that the conspiracy theories and the lies have got some credence because everyone seems to be talking about them.
Well, we do know that repetition, not reputation, creates belief. In other words, if you hear it enough times, it starts to change your beliefs. What we've seen in the data is that the vaccine hesitance that is happening around coronavirus now was foreshadowed by vaccine hesitance around the measles epidemic before it. I don't know if you know this, but in the United States, measles was eradicated in the year 2000. In 2010, there were 63 cases of measles during the entire year in the U.S. And in 2019, there were 1,250 cases in just the first 6 months. And over the year, there was an 1,800% increase in measles in the U.S. And if you look at where measles had outbreaks, you see that they were concentrated in tight-knit communities like Rockland County, New York, and Clark County, Washington. Then if you compare that to the Facebook ad buys for anti-vaccine content, you see that the Facebook ad buys are directed at exactly these tight-knit communities that experience the outbreaks. So I think that there's a lot of growing evidence that misinformation can sway opinions and behaviors, and that it's not just about one topic or another, that it bleeds into many topics at once.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Now, I think the title of your book is great by the use of the word machine, which I thought was absolutely right, because it strikes me that these are problems that have been caused by the design of a machine or the algorithms of social media. These issues have been created as a consequence of the way in which the system has been designed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. The reason I call it the hype machine is it's built on an attention and an engagement economy that's designed to hype us up. And there's actually technical and social and economic elements of this design. And in the book, I outlined four levers, which are money, code, norms, and laws. Money being the business models of these social media platforms that then determine the behaviors of the advertisers and the platforms and the users on the platforms. The code, which as you point to, is the design of the algorithms and the platforms themselves. The norms are how we as a society choose to collectively adopt and use this technology. And of course, the laws are regulation. And each of these is an element of the design of this machine. The laws or lack of laws, the technical design, the social design of the norms we use to adopt it, and of course, the economic design, which I go into in great detail in the book, which centers around network effects and its impact on competition, on the social economy, and as well, the business model. And we're seeing the business model really focus on engagement. And when you focus on engagement, you will provide people with the most salacious, blood-boiling, anger-inducing things because that's what engages them and that's where the profit is to be had.
Absolutely. And I've always thought that's why, going back to your earlier point about the lack of transparency or the unwillingness of some companies to open themselves up for academic research, is because the problems go to the heart of the business, which is if your business is holding people's attention, you're not that bothered about what it is that holds their attention as long as they stay on the site.
Well, I mean, I've talked to Nick Clegg at length about this, and his argument, you know, to be fair, for example, to Facebook as one example of a social platform, he says, well, no, we don't want salacious things because our advertisers don't support that, and they don't want to put their advertisements next to content that they don't believe in. And while I understand that point, and I think he's being truthful, and they do have an incentive to clean out misinformation or salacious content, the engagement principle and the profit made off engagement just outweighs the concern about misinformation to this point. Now, that equation could be tipping. As you say, 2018 was a watershed moment. Opinions are changing over time. But I think we need to continue to voice this opinion to up the pressure and to continue to make an argument for what we want in our social media economy if we hope to make a dent in the business models and the other levers, the money, code, norms, and laws, as I described.
But I think, Nick Clegg is right in absolute terms to say they don't want their advertisers to be upset by their advertising sitting alongside bad content. And indeed, there have been some very good campaigns on that around stop funding hate for profit and brands and advertisers boycotting Facebook for a month in protest at it. But they've come back, and it would seem that the equation for the brand still tilts in favor of using platforms like Facebook because that's where the customers are.
Absolutely. I mean, the economic incentive to market through Facebook is too great to really turn that spigot off for more than a month. And by the way, you know, that month was a drop in the bucket of Facebook's revenue. It didn't really make an economic impact, but I think it did make a zeitgeist impact in the sense that it was a group of very well-known businesses and advertisers taking a stand for the first time, really, with their pocketbook. We need more of that. We need to maintain the pressure.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it is the only times I think the companies have really blinked, I think, is in the face of pressure from the big ad spenders. And I think that is really important. But you touched on laws, obviously, and that's as a lawmaker myself, as you would say, that's a big area of interest for me. And we're seeing in different legislatures around the world new proposals coming in. So in the UK, we have the Online Safety Bill, which is about to start its the draft bill is about to be scrutinised in Parliament by a new joint committee, which will work on that over the next few months, and then probably the legislation will be introduced by the government either at the end of this year or early next year. Europe is consulting on the Digital Services Act, which again looks to create liabilities for tech companies to take down illegal and harmful content. And there is obviously numerous proposals in the United States Congress to end the freedom from liability that tech companies have for content posted by users on their platforms. So we are sort of after what seems like, in certainly parliamentary terms, a long period of debate and analysis. It feels like we're moving into doing something about it. But what do you think we should be aware of? What should we be on the lookout for? Both the things we need to make sure we do and the potential pitfalls on the way.
Well, you mentioned the Digital Services Act. There's also the Digital Markets Act. And I think that that's where I start thinking about this problem. So the way I think about this problem is that it is a systematic or systemic problem. It requires regulation on all of those topics, harmful content and things like that. But we have to go one step deeper and begin with competition. Because right now there's no competition in the social media economy. There is some, but there's not enough competition in the social media economy. And what that means is that the largest platforms have very little incentive to change. They don't face competition where their competitors might say, well, we're going to protect our users' privacy, or we're going to do something about misinformation, or you're not going to see a swath of hate speech on our platform, and users therefore flocking to other new platforms. If that were to happen, you would see things cleaned up very quickly. And so I think that in order to create competition, we have to have structural reforms of the social media economy. Sure, I mean, people say, oh, you mean competition, you mean break up Facebook. I think that's like putting a Band-Aid on a tumor. I'm not against breaking up any one company, but to really make meaningful, sustainable changes that create competition long-term, we need structural reforms to the social media economy. And what that means is interoperability legislation and social network and data portability legislation. This would enable new entrants to overcome the massive network effects that Facebook and Twitter and others enjoy. And if they were able to do that, that might create more long-lasting competition in the social media industry. Once we have competition and now there's financial pressure due to choice on platforms to change, then we also need regulatory pressure on civil liability and as well incentives to draw good lines between free and harmful speech. And so on. And in the book, I detail many different ideas on those topics as well.
And so we've discussed on this program before, I think we get the, it was with Tim Berners-Lee's company in Boston, actually, Inrupt, the idea of users having control of their data profile and deciding which services they would allow to access it, depending on who they choose to do their business with. Is that the sort of model that you mean, where you have a sort of decentralized model where data stays with the user rather than on the platform?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, data portability can be implemented in many different ways. One thing that I see repeatedly is congressmen and women here in the United States and parliamentarians in other countries asking Mark Zuckerberg or other representatives of Facebook and Twitter about data portability, and them being able to answer with a very sort of simple, well, you can download your data now, as if that's a real example of data portability, which is it is not. Because if you, at the time that Mark Zuckerberg gave that answer to Senator Kennedy here in the United States, there was a button that said download your data, and you could download a text file of a list of all of your friends and, you know, the posts that you've made, which is not extensible, non-transferable, and basically useless in terms of portability sense. So I think we have to get serious about the technical definitions of portability, including the ease of transfer and the seamless interoperation between platforms. That's when data portability actually becomes a viable solution to create choice. And it's those types of technologies that need to be supported.
And I think Facebook's been a bit disingenuous about this as well, because it's really saying you can destroy your Facebook data, but you know, you can't really take it and do something else with it. You know, you can destroy it if you want to. They still maintain a residual amount of data about you, even if you do that or not. And of course, they hold more data about what you do off Facebook than what you do on it. And they won't let you take back device level data, not rather than data that's linked directly to your account, but data that's linked to your device, on the basis that not all of the interactions from your device might have been by you, and therefore you don't have a right to have it all. And so I think, you know, the idea that they've got this open and fair system where you can take back your data if you want to, just it's not borne out.
I mean, I think that, you know, we need in the United States federal privacy legislation, data privacy legislation. You know, I think GDPR is a reasonable start. But I think that, you know, if you look across the world, we have these three essential data privacy regimes, and then some others. We have China on one hand, which is essentially a surveillance state. And then we have GDPR in Europe. And then we have the United States, which is trying to figure out what it's going to do. But I think we need to move much more boldly in favor of individuals' data privacy and ownership of data. And I use that term loosely. I don't necessarily mean economic ownership, although maybe I am still trying to fully define in my own mind exactly what that should look like. But what we have today is not sufficient. And I think that good federal data privacy legislation would enable competition and protect users' rights at the same time. And we need to work towards those solutions now.
I think you're right to emphasize competition law as being a really important part of this debate. And indeed, you know, whilst there's legislation on regulating social media companies being progressed in different parliaments around the world, there's also a growing number of antitrust investigations, competition investigations in different jurisdictions as well. And you know, what you're describing to me really does sound like abuse of market power. You know, users don't necessarily like the way their data is used, but they've got no choice. Advertisers don't necessarily like jeopardy of advertising on these platforms, but they've got no choice. When those conditions exist, then you really have got a company that is able to abuse market power through its scale.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. I actually think that the antitrust case that would result in a breakup of Facebook, for example, here in the United States, faces an uphill battle for a number of different reasons that are based in some minutia of law here in the United States and so on. In particular, you know, the basic approach to a breakup would be to split off Instagram and WhatsApp, but those mergers met with oversight and were approved, and then Facebook made many investments into those companies. So I think that there are a number of reasons why that case that may ultimately lead to a breakup faces an uphill battle. But on the other hand, I think there are very clear signs that there is concentration and not enough competition in the social media economy. And while new startups have a chance to sort of come into existence, they don't have enough oxygen to grow to a size that would create pressure to change on the largest platforms. And there hasn't been enough forward-looking merger oversight such that these companies have just been able to be bought out of competition by Facebook and others. And so I think what we need is we need structural reforms to the economy. We need forward-looking and stringent merger oversight to prevent the gobbling up of new entrants by larger companies. And we need to maintain this level of separation for many years if we hope to put pressure to change on the largest platforms.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we've ended up in a system where for many businesses, they've got no option other than to do business through one of the big players. And they don't really have very many rights there. Their fate is really in the hands of that big player. And I think that was very clearly demonstrated with the way Facebook effectively killed off Vine by denying it access to the Facebook graph.
That's right.
Yeah. And the way Zuckerberg was asked by email whether they should do this, and he said, yep, go for it. It really felt like the kind of the emperor in the Colosseum putting his finger down.
That's right.
Now, Charles Creel, it's great to have you with us, as always, and you've been listening into our conversation. What's caught your attention recently?
Well, thanks, Damien. The disinformation mill here in the U.S. is swirling around at the moment, and particularly around the New York City mayor's race. The Democratic nomination for the mayor of New York was announced today, and Brooklyn Bureau President Eric Adams has been announced as the nominee. He's a former police captain. He ran as a representative of the unrepresented working class, but he's also a veteran politician, kind of not unlike the current president of the country. So his win wasn't really surprising. But two turns in the election have started the disinformation engines running, and the Republican Party have taken quick advantage of it in their ongoing campaign to try to demonstrate that the American election machine is both corrupt and broken. First of all, a week ago, the New York Board of Elections botched the release of preliminary ranked choice tabulations, counting 135,000 test ballots that city employees had been using to prove the integrity of the system. Now, the mistake was noticed and corrected within hours, but it provided promoters of right-wing disinformation with better ammunition than they probably could have come up with themselves. And this led Trump supporters to claim that the results of the 2020 presidential ballot in New York may well have been tainted too, and that a recount's in order. Trump himself even suggested the true results of the mayor's race would never be known. And Arkansas Representative Tom Cotton, a Republican, tweeted, quote, "How can anyone trust that a voter's fourth place choice was accurately tabulated on the eighth round of ranking? Look at the debacle in New York City right now." Now, I'm not going to try to explain New York's ranked choice voting system. it's the first year they've used it, and I'm pretty sure I don't understand it. But Trump went on to say at a rally in Texas this week, and the quote goes on a bit, but he said, check out the New York election today, by the way. They just realized it's a disaster. They're unable to count the votes. Did you see it? It just came out. They missed 135,000 votes. They put 135,000 make-believe votes in. Of course, he ended by saying our elections are a disaster. Now, the second incident that adds fuel to this fire is a last minute surge against the winner that came in the final hours of counting. Eric Adams surged in the weeks and last weeks of campaigning, which crossed over a spike of crime in New York. And Adams is a former police captain, which might have added to his popularity. But a last minute count yesterday of 118,000 absentee ballots narrowed his considerable lead to a single percentage point. And again, that fuels questions about election integrity. There are dozens of lawsuits filed by Republicans around the country, and they question the results of last year's national elections and of election integrity in general. And these two glitches in the kind of New York mayoral election matrix are really bound to fuel fires that are going to burn through the coming years. And it's what we're keeping our eye on as we almost enter another election cycle.
Absolutely, and it's concerning to see this narrative around fraudulent ballots continuing even after Trump has left office.
It really is, and there was a story in The Economist, I think it was this week, where they said that somewhere, I can't remember the figure exactly, it was 60 or 70% of Republicans actually believe that Biden lost. And that's tremendous and a really hard thing to go against. And it also shows the dominance of both right-wing media in this country, but also right-wing online media and how much people have put themselves in bubbles.
Absolutely. I mean, Sinan, obviously we have a new administration in America, and people have been very interested in some of the appointments of that administration, particularly on the competition side, people like Tim Wu and Leah Khan. What's your view on the new administration? Do you think they will take a positive approach towards addressing some of these issues around sort of regulation of tech companies?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of pressure. I think that those appointments are a good sign. You know, obviously, Tim Wu and Leah Khan are ardently anti-monopoly, especially in the tech area. Leah Khan having written an influential law review article about specifically Amazon and its monopoly status. And Tim Wu has been an advocate for many years about competition reform in the U.S. We'll see, you know, whether or not there are dramatic changes that come or not. I think that obviously we also have David Cicilline here in the House of Representatives that's leading a committee that has just been releasing multiple reports and draft legislation around competition in the U.S. And I think that, you know, we are right in the heart of that process right now as we speak. You know, interestingly, Leah Khan, being appointed to the FCC, I think, the FTC, the Amazon spokesperson came out and said that we believe that she needs to recuse herself from anything that has to do with Amazon because she was writing about the Amazon case prior to being appointed and so on. So we'll see how those types of things, you know, shape up. I don't think it's something that the executive branch here in the United States is going to do by itself. I think that legislation in Congress is going to be a big part of this, especially when it comes to systematic reforms. I think that there are bills, like the Access Act that are sitting in front of Congress. The Access Act would require by law that any platform greater than 100 million users become interoperable with other platforms. I think laws like that would create a lot of competition. So I'm not sure that the FTC or the FCC, which are, you know, five-person politically appointed commissions, are the only avenue to make meaningful change. I think that we also have to have a very significant contribution from the Congress in writing legislation. that will create sustainable competition?
I think that's right. We've had David Cicilline's been on the podcast, and I think his committee's report last year, the antitrust subcommittee's report, was really excellent at laying out the regulatory issues that exist in different, in what are a series of monopolies in online, and really I think exposed the idea that, you know, these, although superficially it looks like there's Facebook, Google, and Amazon, these are all different companies, and therefore they're all tech companies to some extent, they compete, but actually what they are is siloed into a series of very significant virtual monopolies that they control.
Well, I mean, I think one thing that your listeners might be interested to know is that in the United States, we've had a very narrow history of our interpretation of competition and anti-monopoly. And that is essentially the Chicago School of Economics and its view that the way to figure out whether monopolies should be busted or whether we need competition legislation is in looking at consumer harm, and that consumer harm should be narrowly defined as artificially high prices. And of course, in digital markets, the prices are zero. So nobody pays for Facebook. And so there's really no way to judge Facebook on creating consumer harm from that narrow Chicago school definition of consumer harm being about prices. And so what Lina Khan and others and Tim Wu and others have argued in recent times is that not only do we need legislation coming out of Congress, not only do we need better merger oversight from the executive branch, but we need to understand that we have to fundamentally change our perception of what it means to be a monopoly in the digital age and what competition means in the digital age. We have to evolve from this notion of consumer harm being just about prices to consumer harm being about a lot of other things like hate speech and the spread of misinformation and the loss of privacy and the other things that market leaders do not have to correct if they are not faced with competition.
Now, before we close, I just wanted to go back to the social media summit that you mentioned that was held at MIT in April. You'll be pleased to know I had a look earlier to see who had appeared at that. And you are now the seventh person who was at that summit to appear on the Infotainment podcast. Right? That says something about the quality we get on here. You won't be surprised to know that Nick Clegg is not amongst that seven, but nevertheless, for some very distinguished people who have. Before we close, perhaps you could just say where people can find that report. So I'm sure if there are people who haven't read that report, we'll be very interested to see what you've come up with.
Yes, I don't know what the exact website is off the top of my head, but I can send it to you and you can share it with your listeners.
Yeah,
you can find more of this at the Initiative on the Digital Economy at MIT, which would be ide.mit.edu. And you can find out more about me at sinanaral.io.
That's fantastic. Well, Sinan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been really great to chat to you. And I very much enjoyed The Hype Machine. I hope other people who haven't yet got a copy of it, make sure they do.
Really appreciate the invitation. It's fantastic to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Infotainment podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Sinan Aral and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/infotainmentpodcast. Infotainment is a not-for-profit organization, and all proceeds will go towards the making of the show. Thank you. Until next time.